This content is AI-generated for informational purposes only and should not be directly used for clinical decision-making.
Hello and welcome back to the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris, Senior Attending Neurosurgeon.
And I'm Dr. Alara, Research Fellow. Today we're looking at a fascinating new study from the journal Child's Nervous System, published in 2026. It's titled Epidermoid Cysts of the Cerebellopontine Angle in Pediatric Population, an Institutional Surgical Case Series and Review of Literature, coming out of the Oslo University Hospital in Norway.
This is a great topic because, as any attending will tell you, when we think of epidermoid cysts, or ECs, we typically think of adult patients. The literature generally puts the mean age of presentation around 40 years. Seeing them in the pediatric population is actually quite rare.
Exactly. The paper notes that ECs account for only about 0.2% to 1.8% of all intracranial tumors across all ages, but specifically in the cerebellopontine angle, or CPA, they represent only about 5% of pediatric tumors encountered in that location. Because they are so uncommon in children, data on surgical complications and recurrence rates are still somewhat limited.
Right, and the authors, Elbana and colleagues, really wanted to bridge that gap by looking at their institutional experience over a 20-year period, from 2004 to 2024. Alara, let's dive into the pathophysiology first. How do these lesions actually form?
The consensus, which this paper reinforces, is that ECs arise from the inadvertent inclusion of ectodermal elements during neural tube closure. This traps these elements in the diploid, meninges, scalp, or suture lines. Most of these in the CNS are overwhelmingly intradural. Interestingly, the paper mentions that while intradiploid cysts can occur secondary to trauma, the CPA lesions we're discussing are developmental.
And because they grow so slowly, essentially from the accumulation of desquamated keratin and cholesterol, they tend to wrap themselves around the existing anatomy rather than displacing it aggressively at first. This is why the surgical challenge in the CPA is so high. You have all those critical cranial nerves and the brainstem involved.
Let's look at who these patients were. The study included 6 pediatric patients, age 18 or younger, with at least 1 year of follow-up. The mean age was 15, with a range of 12 to 17. So we're looking at adolescents mostly. The male-to-female ratio was 1:2.
And how did they present clinically?
Headache was the most common symptom, seen in 83% of cases. That's 5 out of 6 patients. Ataxia was present in 33%. Other symptoms included dizziness, jaw pain, and reduced hearing. One patient even had papilledema on ophthalmoscopy.
That's a fairly nonspecific presentation for the CPA, except for the hearing and jaw pain, which point towards cranial nerve involvement. For the residents listening, let's talk imaging. In this series, what was the gold standard for diagnosis?
The authors emphasize that MRI is key, specifically the diffusion-weighted sequence, or DWI. They found restricted diffusion was the most specific radiological sign for an epidermoid cyst. On T2-weighted images, these lesions appeared slightly hyperintense compared to CSF. They actually used a high-resolution, heavily T2-weighted sequence to accurately measure the diameter of the cysts.
And these weren't small lesions.
No, the mean diameter was 37 millimeters, ranging from 30 to 45. To put that in perspective for the students, these lesions were extending from the level of cranial nerve 3 all the way down to the lower cranial nerves, 6, 7, 8, and in half the cases down to 9 through 11.
That is a massive amount of real estate in the posterior fossa. Let's talk about the surgical management. The paper states they used a conventional retrosigmoid approach for all patients. They used the park bench position and a microsurgical retraction-free technique. Alara, what did they see once they got in there?
They described the classic pearl-like appearance intraoperatively. If you look at the figures in the paper, there's a striking image of the cyst sitting in the window between cranial nerves 5 and 8.
That pearly, flaky keratin is very pathognomonic. Now, the big question in EC surgery is always gross total resection versus subtotal resection. What was their success rate?
They achieved gross total resection, or GTR, in 4 out of 6 patients, which is about 67%. This was confirmed by immediate postoperative MRI.
And for the other two?
Those were subtotal resections. The paper is very honest about the difficulty. They mention that while GTR is the goal, residual tissue often persists in hidden anatomical recesses. In fact, if we look at their results, even one patient who had a documented GTR eventually showed a recurrence.
That's a critical point for the practicing neurosurgeons listening. Even when your intraoperative view and your immediate post-op MRI look clean, the microscopic remnants of the cyst wall, which is the living part of the cyst, can lead to recurrence.
Exactly. One of the patients had a remnant in Meckel's cave that was documented on the first postoperative MRI. But interestingly, that specific remnant didn't show growth on the latest follow-up.
That brings us to the complications. We worry about the cranial nerves in the CPA. How did these children fare?
The outcomes were actually quite favorable. There was no mortality and no permanent morbidity. Postoperative complications were limited to transient diplopia in one patient and hearing impairment in another. So 34% had some transient issue, but they recovered. This suggests that in the hands of experienced surgeons, these can be removed safely.
Let's talk about the recurrence data they found, because that's where the long-term management gets tricky.
Recurrence was observed in two patients. One was after a known subtotal resection, which isn't surprising. But as you mentioned, the other recurrence happened in a patient where they thought they had achieved GTR. The authors recommend long-term MRI follow-up because of this.
Did they offer any specific technical advice for improving the completeness of the resection?
They did. They suggested that endoscopic assistance may enhance the completeness of the resection. The endoscope allows you to look around the corner into those hidden recesses that the microscope can't reach, especially around the nerves and the brainstem.
I agree. The endoscope is a game changer for ECs. They also mentioned that small asymptomatic remnants can be monitored rather than aggressively chased if it puts the cranial nerves at high risk.
Yes, they emphasize that residual tissue may persist in hidden anatomical recesses and predispose to recurrence. But since these are slow-growing, you have time. The main takeaway for the pediatric population is that while these are rare, the retrosigmoid approach is safe and effective.
It's also worth noting the symptoms again. If an adolescent presents with a persistent headache and you see ataxia or any cranial nerve signs, an MRI with DWI is a must. You don't want to miss an epidermoid cyst just because it's statistically an adult disease.
The review of literature they included also supports this. While pediatric CPA epidermoids are a small fraction of the total cases, the surgical philosophy remains consistent. Prioritize the preservation of neurological function while aiming for total removal of the cyst wall whenever possible.
Before we wrap up, let's look at the follow-up period. This study looked at patients with more than 1 year of follow-up, but some of their patients were followed for much longer. One patient was followed for 246 months. That's over 20 years.
That really highlights the slow-growing nature. In that 246-month case, the patient had a subtotal resection and relief of their headache, and they didn't have a recurrence despite the remnant. It shows that the natural history of these remnants can be quite variable.
It's a great reminder that in pediatric neurosurgery, we aren't just treating a lesion. We are managing a patient who has 70 or 80 years of life ahead of them.
To summarize the paper's conclusions for our listeners, EC of the CPA in children can be safely removed with low morbidity. GTR is the goal, but subtotal removal is sometimes necessary to protect anatomy. Recurrence is a real risk, even after GTR, so long-term MRI, specifically with DWI, is mandatory. And finally, consider using the endoscope to help clear those hidden spots.
Excellent summary, Alara. This study, while small, provides high-quality longitudinal data on a very rare pediatric condition. It's a must-read for anyone rotating on a pediatric neurosurgery service.
Definitely. It's published in Child's Nervous System, May 2026.
That's all the time we have for today. Thank you for joining us on the Neurosurgery Hub podcast. I'm Dr. Aris.
And I'm Dr. Alara. We'll see you in the next episode.